Hello and welcome to The Top Story, a podcast with the headlines of the day from our correspondents around the world. I'm Shane Bigham, coming up in this edition. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres's welcome reports that stakeholders in Haiti have nominated representatives to a transitional council to restore order in the Caribbean nation. A glimmer of hope's emerging from the Gaza negotiations as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says the gap is narrowing. And leaders and activists have assembled in Brussels at the first ever summit on nuclear energy. We begin in the Americas. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres's welcome reports that stakeholders in Haiti have nominated representatives to a transitional council to restore order in the Caribbean nation. The UN Humanitarian Coordinator for Haiti says gangs in Port-au-Prince have worsened conditions in the capital, and sources have told Reuters a gang leader was killed on Thursday. As the risk of famine spreads, many Haitians continue to cross into the Dominican Republic to seek food, Nick Harper reports from the border area.
Hundreds of people are streaming across the border between the Dominican Republic and Haiti. And we're seeing this situation where there are plenty of people coming across the border from Haiti with their goods to sell, but as well as the traders who are hoping to get more money by crossing into another country. We're seeing plenty of people coming across with empty wheelbarrows, empty cars, empty vehicles, because they are hoping that on the other side they will find food. The United Nations is warning that the situation in Haiti is growing increasingly dire from not just a security point of view, a humanitarian point of view, but also from a food security point of view. They say about 1.4 million Haitians are currently on the verge of famine. An extra 4 million are food insecure. People streaming across the border in their hundreds, in their thousands during the course of any given day to try and collect food by the barrow load, by the carload that they can take back to Haiti to give to their family members, but also to sell as well. This is a very heavily fortified border. The Dominican Republic police and military are here on the border. There is razor wire, there are border fences, all of those already in place from the Dominican Republic, which for a long time has tried to keep this border secure. But security has, of course, increased with many more people carrying guns, making sure that the situation here on the border with people desperately trying to get food aid doesn't become more volatile.
That was Nick Harper on the crisis in Haiti. In the Middle East, a glimmer of light's emerging at the end of the tunnel of Gaza negotiations. The UN Security Council is set to vote on a U.S. draft resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and a hostage-prisoner swap. The U.S. has previously vetoed similar resolutions. In Egypt, Arab ministers and a top Palestinian official suggested implementing measures for a two-state solution to U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Blinken says the gap's narrowing. Adel Al-Maruki has more from Cairo.
Besides his usual meetings with Egyptian and Qatari representatives who are leading the mediation efforts between Israelis and the Palestinians, the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with an expanded diplomats from the Arab world, a collection of foreign ministers that included Jordan, Saudi Arabia, UAE, a Palestinian Liberation Organization, and the Prime Minister of Qatar, along with the Egyptian Foreign Minister, together sat with the U.S. Secretary of State to discuss the developments in the ceasefire talks, through which both Egypt and the United States Secretary of State says that progress has been made. They did not, however, give any details about what kind of progress or when a deal for brokering another ceasefire in Gaza could be expected.
In all the meetings, there was a focus on the situation of the war in Gaza and the importance to reach a ceasefire and hostage release and to work on intensifying the amount of humanitarian aid.
We've been working, as you know, with Egypt, with Qatar, and with Israel to put a strong proposal on the table. Hamas responded to that. The negotiators continue to work. The gaps are narrowing, and we're continuing to push for an agreement in Doha.
On the other hand, the talks with the expanded version of the Arab foreign ministers also included the future plans for the Palestinian occupied territory, specifically how to govern Gaza once this crisis is over. Also, the U.S. Secretary of State discussed coordination with these Arab countries, basically the most influential countries when it comes to the Palestinian countries, and how to revive peace talks and push forward for a lasting peace, to which the foreign minister stressed that only a two-state solution based on UN Security Council resolutions and on the 1967 borders is what they would accept as a lasting solution for the Palestinian crisis. On the other hand, the Egyptian foreign minister warned about grave consequences if Israel proceeds with a ground invasion to Rafah City, the city that borders Egypt and Gaza, and almost two-thirds of the Palestinian population in Gaza are taking shelter and camping there. El-Sisi fears that a military expansion there could jeopardize Egypt's national security and cause regional implications, as more casualties could be expected with this military expansion inside Rafah City. What Israel says is imminent, but the United States, as well as Egypt, Thursday, both stressed that they reject this step by Israel, and Egypt said it will take all measures it can to prevent this step from happening.
That was Adel Al-Marouki reporting from Cairo. As Israel is sending the head of its spy agency back to Doha for negotiations, fighting continues in Gaza. Israel says its raid on Al-Shifa Hospital in northern Gaza has killed more than 140 Palestinian militants, and they've arrested several senior Hamas officials. The very limited amount of aid has not been enough to keep the humanitarian situation in Gaza from deteriorating. Associated Press correspondent Sam Mednick has more from Jerusalem.
On Thursday, Israel's prime minister's office said that they were sending the head of the Mossad spy agency back to Qatar to continue talks and to meet the head of the CIA, as well as other mediation negotiators to discuss the ceasefire. These talks began at the beginning of this week in Qatar, and Qatari officials have characterized things as being cautiously optimistic. You know, these talks are being brokered by the United States, Qatar, as well as Egypt, and they're focusing right now on this first phase, which could look like a six-week ceasefire with about 100 hostages who are being held in Gaza exchanged for Palestinian prisoners being held in Israel. There's believed to be about 250 hostages who were taken when Hamas attacked Israel on October 7th. About half of them were released during a weeks-long ceasefire in November. There's believed to be about 130 who remain, but Israel's government says that about a quarter of them are dead. I spoke on Thursday to the relative, his name's Ricardo, his nephew is being held in Gaza right now. He said that this is a positive development. He hopes that the CIA pressures both sides to come to a decision, but he said that him and the other families are hearing contradictory information on a daily basis and that it is getting harder and harder to bear. Meanwhile, the humanitarian situation in Gaza is getting worse and worse. On Thursday, the World Health Organization said that there were 60% of children under the age of five in Gaza were malnourished. This is up from 1% before the beginning of the war. The head of the World Health Organization, he said that not enough food was getting into Gaza and that most families were missing at least one meal. This comes after another alarming report where aid groups in the United Nations says that famine is imminent in the north of Gaza and that by July more than a million people are going to be facing catastrophic levels of hunger. Now, countries are doing what they can in any way to get assistance into Gaza. For the first time, shipments came by sea, and then commercial ships can be employed to take food and assistance from Cyprus coming into Gaza. But all of this is happening while Israel continues offensives inside Gaza. On Thursday, for the fourth day in a row, they raided the Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. Israel says that Hamas is using it as a base that they've regrouped there. Israel says that they have detained about 600 people, killed about 140 Hamas fighters, they said, and that they found weapons as well as documents inside the hospital. There's about 30,000 people sheltering in that hospital. Many of them are displaced. Gaza's health ministry said that in the last 24 hours, there have been at least 65 bodies brought into hospital and more than 90 people have been injured.
That was Sam Mednick reporting from Jerusalem. In Europe, Ukraine says Russia launched its largest missile attack in weeks on Kyiv on Thursday, injuring at least 17 people. Russian President Vladimir Putin has vowed retribution for Ukrainian strikes into Russia's border region. Meanwhile, European Union leaders have agreed to move forward on a plan to use the profits from frozen Russian central bank assets to arm Ukraine, as Kyiv pleads for more military aid from the West. Megumi Lim reports.
Kyiv was rocked by loud explosions in the early hours of Thursday as air defense systems worked to shoot down missiles launched by Russia. According to Ukraine's Air Force, all 31 cruise and ballistic missiles aimed at the capital and its surrounding region were shot down. But officials say falling debris caused damages to residential buildings, schools, and industrial facilities. The head of Kyiv's military administration, Serhiy Popko, said Russia used strategic bombers and launched missiles from its territory, targeting the capital from different directions. He said debris fell in the Podilsky, Shevchenkivsky, and Sviatoshin districts, causing fires and some windows to be blown out by the shockwaves. City officials said at least 17 people were injured, including an 11-year-old girl. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky condemned the attacks and renewed his call for more air defense systems from Western allies. The attacks come after Russian President Vladimir Putin accused Kyiv last week of launching strikes against Russia to disrupt the presidential elections. He said Ukraine will not go unpunished for the attacks. Meanwhile, Russia's defense ministry said in a statement that its air defense systems shot down 10 rockets launched by Ukraine against the border region of Belgorod on Thursday. It said the region's largest sports and cultural facility were damaged in the attack.
That was Megumi Lim reporting. Leaders and activists have assembled in Brussels at the first ever summit on nuclear energy. It comes as countries look to fission as a way to guarantee energy independence, transition away from fossil fuels, and boost economic development. But not all agree that nuclear is the way to go. Stuart Smith reports.
The aim is to revitalize the use of atomic power around the world. COP28 called for the tripling of global nuclear capacity by 2050, and a repeated refrain in Brussels on Thursday was no net zero without nuclear power. The EU gets 40% of its energy from fossil fuels, 40% from renewable sources, and 20% from atomic energy. Nuclear's percentage in that breakdown has gone down since 2000 from a third to a fifth, and only two nuclear power plants have been connected to the EU grid since 2010. Cost was one of the most frequently expressed concerns at the summit.
Given the urgency of the climate challenge, countries need to consider their options carefully before they forego a readily available source of low-emission electricity. Extending the safe operation of today's nuclear fleet is one of the cheapest ways to secure clean power at scale.
Another way delegates are discussing addressing the challenge of money is finding new ways of funding. Private investment was repeated as a way to help encourage power plant construction, with governments often spooked by the huge costs involved and the decades-long timeline for construction. The grandson of the man whose team of scientists created the nuclear bomb now campaigns to use nuclear for peace. Charles Oppenheimer believes that private capital could make the key difference.
If you look back 20 years ago, renewable energy per megawatt hour was almost uninvestable, but private firms and government entities did get into it at higher rates, and by increasing that rate of investment, it's decreased in price over time. So right now we're just at the beginning point. If we could do one nuclear project with 20% private equity capital matching government, that would be a huge step.
Some still see a need for caution. Activists gathered as delegates arrived to protest the risk of nuclear pollution from waste or accidents. Others say it's a dangerous distraction when cheap renewable energy, such as solar and wind, is abundantly available. And with traditional nuclear power plants taking decades to build, they claim there's no time to raise money for and then build nuclear power stations if we have any chance of reaching net zero carbon emissions by 2050. Delegates here claim it's all needed.
That was Stuart Smith on the first summit on nuclear energy. And finally, in Asia, American tech giant Apple has opened a new flagship store in Shanghai. It's the Chinese megacity's eighth Apple store and the company's second biggest globally. Wu Bin reports.
It's around 6 p.m. at Jing'an, one of the busiest districts. There's a huge crowd waiting for something important. What they're waiting for is the opening of a new Apple store in the city.
Many Apple fans even queued the night before to become the first customers. At 7 o'clock, Apple CEO Tim Cook and staff at the new store welcomed the first batch of customers outside. Apple Jing'an is now the company's flagship store in China and the second biggest after Fifth Avenue in New York City. The new store covers over 3,800 square meters and has attracted more than 18 million yuan, or nearly $12 million, in investment. The opening of the new store in Shanghai brings the total number in the Greater China region to 57. Despite facing fierce competition from Chinese smartphone giants, the American firm continues to have faith in the market. It has invested 1 billion yuan, or nearly 140 million US dollars, into its applied research lab in Shanghai and will now open a new one in Shenzhen, Guangdong Province. On Tuesday, China's State Council released an action plan to attract foreign investment. It says the country will carry out pilot projects to relax requirements for foreign investment access in certain fields, including technological innovation. During Tim Cook's trip to Shanghai, the Apple CEO has met with local suppliers, including the president of BYD. He's also expected to head to Beijing to meet senior policymakers to attend the China Development Forum next week.
That was Ubin reporting from Shanghai. Recapping today's headlines, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has welcomed reports that stakeholders in Haiti have nominated representatives to a transitional council to restore order in the Caribbean nation. A glimmer of hope's emerging from the Gaza negotiations, as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says the gap is narrowing. And leaders and activists have assembled in Brussels at the first ever summit on nuclear energy. That's it for this edition of The Top Story, a podcast that brings you world headlines every weekday. For more news in politics, business, sport, and culture, you can subscribe to The Beijing Hour, a one-hour news magazine podcast program. We welcome and appreciate all ratings and reviews. I'm Shane Bigham. Thanks for listening.